Russia claims to control the eastern Ukrainian town of Soledar as Ukrainian soldiers are seen withdrawing.
Journalists who are currently staying there, they said and they confirmed that they've been witnessing Ukrainian forces withdrawing today from the city of Soledar.
A conversation with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
The Ukrainians are willing to fight. They're willing to suffer in order to sustain an international system in which it is not acceptable to extinguish your smaller neighbor by military force. That's what is at stake here.
And also, we meet the people investigating allegations of torture in Kherson. Today is Friday, January 13th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. Amid conflicting reports over who controls Soledar, CNN journalists on the ground are reporting that Ukrainian troops are withdrawing to fallback positions outside the city. We'll have more from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv in a few minutes. This as Russia's defense ministry claims its forces have captured the eastern Ukraine city. From the Associated Press, Charles Della Desma reports.
The ministry says Soledar, the focus of a bloody battle between Russian and Ukrainian forces, was captured on Thursday night. There was no immediate confirmation from Ukrainian authorities to Russia's claim to have seized the town in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk region, one of four Ukrainian areas that Moscow has illegally annexed. Soledar's fall would mark a rare victory for the Kremlin after a series of battlefield setbacks in its invasion of Ukraine. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
As we've heard, Russia said on Friday that its forces have taken control of Soledar, claiming to have made its first big battlefield gain after half a year of military setbacks. The defense ministry said Russian forces captured the town, long the focus of heavy fighting and bombardment, on Thursday evening. Igor Konashenkov is Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson.
On the evening of January 12th, the liberation of Soledar was complete. The town is important for continuing the Russian advance on the Donetsk axis. Taking full control of Soledar enables Russia to cut off the Ukrainian forces' supplies to Artyomovsk, Bakhmut, which is located to the southwest from Soledar, and after that, to block and encircle the Ukrainian army divisions that remain there. The capture of Soledar became possible thanks to constant fire damage to the enemy, to the actions of the assault and army aviation, the missile corps and artillery of the Russian forces. They continually carried out focused strikes against Ukrainian army positions in the town, removing their ability to move reserves, supply weapons, and attempt to withdraw enemy troops to other defensive lines.
Asked about Russian control of Soledar on Thursday afternoon, U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said he could not confirm that Russia has taken the town, but he noted,
"But even if both Bakhmut and Soledar fall to the Russians, it's not going to make it's not going to have a strategic impact on the war itself, and it certainly isn't going to stop the Ukrainians or slow them down in terms of their efforts to regain their territory." And I would remind, I mean, I know we're all focused on those two towns right now, but just, again, take a couple of steps back, and if you look at what's been happening over the last 10 and a half months, particularly in the Donbas, towns and villages have swapped hands quite frequently. So my last comment would be, don't count the Ukrainians out.
VOA was not able to immediately verify Russia's claim. Ukrainian troops seen leaving Soledar. We'll have that update in a few minutes. Now, Ukrainian prosecutors have shared exclusively with Reuters the most comprehensive numbers yet on the scale of alleged torture by Russian troops during their former occupation of Kherson. One resident described an ordeal so brutal that she says it required plastic surgery. Reuters' Matthew Laratonda reports.
When you have a bag on your head and you're being beaten, there is such a vacuum. You cannot breathe. You cannot do anything. You cannot defend yourself. When they started to pull out my fingernails, one pain grew into another. I had only one wish.
That wish, Oksana Minenko says, was to die and join her husband, a Ukrainian soldier lost in combat on the first day of Russia's invasion. Her captors had forced her to remove her clothes, she says, and beat her face so badly that it required plastic surgery. At one point, they put her hands in boiling water. Reuters couldn't verify her story, although allegations of torture by Russian troops against civilians in Ukraine are widespread. Moscow has always denied that its military targets civilians or that it's committed war crimes there. But now, Ukrainian prosecutors have shared exclusively with Reuters the most comprehensive numbers yet on the scale of these allegations in one particular area, the region of Kherson that was formerly occupied by Russian forces. It includes 10 sites identified so far for what prosecutors call unlawful detentions, 200 people allegedly tortured or physically assaulted at those sites, 400 detained there. 540 civilians are said to be still missing. Of 50,000 reports of war crimes nationwide, 7,700 come from the Kherson region. Andriy Kovalenko is Kherson's chief war crimes prosecutor.
The most common types of torture were electric shocks, applying electric wires to genitals, ears, pouring water on people. This was done systematically, exhaustingly, in order to obtain statements the occupiers required. Batons, wooden sticks were used to beat people. We also found gas masks that were used to suffocate people.
Reuters has been visiting the alleged torture sites. One in the basement of an office building in Kherson has etchings on the walls said to be from prisoners. The smell of human feces fills the air. Minenko, the accountant, says she believes she was targeted because of her husband's military service. Men in Russian uniforms showed up at his gravesite, she says, and staged a mock execution of her, firing bullets by her head. They also dragged her from her house in the night 3 times for the beatings.
I did not lose consciousness. They did not rape me. But at this stage, I was like raw meat. One might say I was a living corpse.
Both the Kremlin and Russia's defense ministry didn't respond to Reuters' questions for this report.
That's Matthew Laratonda of Reuters News. Russia claims to have taken control of Soledar. What's the official reaction from the Ukrainian government? I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to find out. So, Anna, we're hearing that the Russian military is confirming that they control Soledar, that they've taken it. Has there been a reaction from the Ukrainian government yet?
Well, for the moment, we don't have official confirmation and official reaction from the Ukrainian side. It might come later on during this evening in Ukraine. But again, we will see what we know for the moment. So Ukrainians neither confirm nor say that this is not true. I think what is important to mention that yesterday Ukrainian officials, military officials mentioned that Ukrainian forces, so the battle isn't going, but Ukrainian forces already have prepared positions that they will take if it's needed. So basically, we are hearing that Ukrainians are kind of, you know, having this plan B to withdraw to particular positions. What we're also hearing from the city of Soledar, from our colleagues from CNN, journalists who are currently staying there, they said and they confirmed that they've been witnessing Ukrainian forces withdrawing today from the city of Soledar. They said that it was very pretty much organized withdrawal, and they did not mention any panic within Ukrainian forces. So it kind of goes in line with what Ukrainian military said yesterday in terms of these prepared positions, like plan B positions. So it looks like that most of the city of Soledar is under Russian control, at least according to the maps that we have from general staff and also from our international colleagues around the world, and particularly journalists who are located there. What is also worth mentioning is that U.S. officials, as well as Institute for the Study of War, said that control of Soledar would not change much operation situation on the front line. Institute for the Study of War said that the control of the city of Soledar by Russian forces would not provide them a position of so the possibility to surrender Bakhmut as much as they wanted.
So clearly a developing story. As of this recording, no word yet from the Ukrainian government on the condition of Soledar, but we'll keep our eyes open for that and bring you an update as soon as we can. Anna Chernikova, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Condoleezza Rice, former U.S. Secretary of State under President George W. Bush, as well as the current director of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and former Obama Administration Defense Secretary Robert Gates, recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post entitled "Time Is Not on Ukraine's Side," where they advocated that the United States should provide Ukraine with more powerful weapons and in greater numbers. Rice spoke via Zoom from her office in California with Tatiana Voroshko, managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service. I asked Tatiana what they discussed.
In this op-ed published earlier, about a week ago, they argued for a dramatic increase by the U.S. and its allies in military supplies and capability, above all mobile armor, to enable Ukraine to push back Russian forces. They call on the U.S. and its allies to act decisively now before more is demanded from them. So she kind of underlined that in this situation, unlike during the World War One, World War II, United States troops don't have to go in. And in Ukraine, United States and its allies has a willing partner which defends not only itself, but the rule-based order and democracy.
That's Tatiana Voroshko of VOA's Ukrainian service. She began her conversation with Condoleezza Rice by asking her to respond to critics, including many Republicans, who say that Washington is already helping Ukraine too much.
Well, I would say that we are assisting Ukraine a great deal. And we have actually appropriated the monies through Congress to assist even more. This is really more a call for urgency about it, that we need to get Ukraine the tools that it needs so that it can continue to push back the Russian aggressor. We could have, let me just give you an example. We probably could have predicted months ago that Ukraine was going to need air defenses because the only thing left to Vladimir Putin was to use terrorist tactics and have missile attacks against Ukrainian civilian centers. We could have predicted that. So let's be ahead of the curve and get Ukraine what it needs. And the other thing that I would say is the United States has to remember that every time we've waited, 1914, 1941, 2001, we've always had to enter. And this time around, no one is asking for our troops. The Ukrainians are willing to fight. They're willing to suffer in order to sustain an international system in which it is not acceptable to extinguish your smaller neighbor by military force. That's what is at stake here. And America has a tremendous interest in sending a lesson to the Russians that that is not going to be allowed.
There's certainly, so on a certain level, there is a push on Ukraine, not on the official US level, but a certain level push on Ukraine to start negotiating with Russia at this point. You seem to be thinking of the otherwise.
Yes, negotiations, diplomacy follows the situation on the ground, not the other way around. And so we need to make sure that when there are negotiations, and there will eventually be, that Ukraine is in the strongest possible position. And that isn't now. We are seeing that the Russians are making a push again in Donetsk. Vladimir Putin declared Donetsk and Luhansk to be Russian territory. He can't negotiate away Russian territory. So to ask for negotiations now is, first of all, probably going to be fruitless. and to possibly leave the Russians in a better position than they would otherwise be if we allow the Ukrainians to push them back further. I would be the last person to say when negotiations should begin. I think we have to say that the Ukrainian people who've suffered war crimes, who've suffered the destruction of their territory, who have seen Ukrainian citizens taken away by the Russians, to tell them negotiate now seems to me not something that we can defend as Americans. Right now, our job is to help Ukraine, to help us to reestablish that, and that the kind of thing that the Russians did is simply not going to succeed in the world of 2023. If you look at those pictures, they look like they're from 1939. We did this once, and it didn't turn out so well. So let's make sure that Ukraine has what it needs to fight our fight.
You knew and you met Putin personally. You knew him quite well. In your opinion, now, is he a rational actor? I mean, can he even engage in rational dialogue, or is he already beyond that point?
Well, he's rational in the sense that he understands what he's trying to do. And we've seen shifting Russian priorities. You know, at first it was to go to Kyiv and overthrow the Ukrainian government. And then it sort of dialed back to the east and the south. And when that wasn't really, you know, to cut off Ukraine at Odessa, when that wasn't possible, they've moved back again. So I think he's rational. But to be rational doesn't mean that you don't have ambitions that are ideological, that are emotional. And there, I think this is about reconstructing the Russian Empire. And you can't have an independent Ukraine and reconstruct the Russian Empire. And so there's something deeply emotional about this for Putin. That doesn't mean irrational, but it does mean that it is something deeply emotional and perhaps right now not negotiable in his way of thinking. And so you have to help Ukraine, let him see that it's not going to be possible, that no matter how much he would like to achieve that, it's not going to happen. And then we'll see whether rationality takes over.
You were state secretary in 2008 during the Bucharest summit when Georgia and Ukraine were denied membership action plan. It did not happen. In retrospect, do you think that was a mistake?
Well, we in the Bush administration argued for Ukraine and Georgia to have MAP at the Bucharest summit. But NATO is a consensus organization and the consensus was not there. And so we did the next best thing, which was to express that one day Ukraine and Georgia would be a part of NATO. I don't like leaving a vacuum in international politics. And when you think about it, geographically, we have protected Poland and Romania and others on the periphery of Ukraine because they have an Article 5 guarantee from the United States. And by not even giving Ukraine a pathway to NATO membership, perhaps that left a vacuum. I think now, with the bravery of the Ukrainians, what one thing that Vladimir Putin has done is he's actually driven Ukraine closer to NATO, not as a member, but as a beneficiary of everything NATO can provide short of troops. He has, someone said, Vladimir Putin has managed to end German pacifism and Swedish neutrality all within a year. I think we are going to see a NATO with Sweden and Finland as members. I would never have dreamed of this when we were there in 2008. So it has come at great cost to the Ukrainian people, and I don't want to minimize that. But when we succeed in helping Ukraine to repel the Russian aggression, whatever that means, whatever that final settlement is, we will have changed the face of Europe for the better. And for that, we have the Ukrainian people to thank.
What about now? Would you still argue for NATO to accept Ukraine even before the hostilities over?
I think it is difficult to do that because it comes with a guarantee that I would not want to test, frankly, and give Putin a kind of moral victory if you set off discussions in NATO about what does it mean and so forth. I think where we are now, if we are, as Bob Gates and I argued, fully committed to Ukraine's defense through what we can provide so that the Ukrainians can defend themselves, that's where we need to be. Now, the time will come when I think, and President Zelensky has said this, when we have to think about how to secure Ukraine in the future, what kinds of security guarantees there need to be. But I think that is for another time. Let's do everything that we can right now to repel the aggression and to do it with a sense of urgency so that when we get to the period of reconstruction after the war, Ukraine is in a stronger position.
There seems to be a good consensus between Ukrainian and U.S. administration about how the Ukrainian victory would look like. It's restoring Ukrainian sovereignty and holding Russia responsible for its action. But how would the Russian defeat look like?
Well, I don't want to talk about the Russian defeat. I am hoping that there is, from the Russian perspective, an understanding that they already have not achieved their goals. In that sense, they've already achieved, there's already been a defeat. You know, people were talking about Kyiv falling in 5 days. We know that the Russians went with their dress uniforms for the parade in Kyiv. So much has already been accomplished when it comes to what Russian goals initially were. Now it's the Russian goal of hanging on to territory that they illegally annexed. That's the next goal that we need to have with pushing the Russians back from their intended ambitions. And then we'll see where it goes from there. But I think if we focus on the task at hand right now, it is to make sure that they cannot secure illegally the annexed territory. And that's the battle that's going on in Donetsk as we speak. That will be the battle for the south. But they also didn't succeed in the south, which they had intended to. You know, Kherson is under attack, but it's free. And so in a war, it's good to keep the long-term goals in mind, but it's more important to win the short-term goals as you move forward.
Go back to this 2008, the fateful year. Do you believe that the response to Putin's aggression in Georgia should have been much stronger, and then again in 2014 in Ukraine? So is there anything you would blame the Bush administration or the subsequent Obama administration for creating the condition for Putin to go on full-scale invasion?
Perhaps there could have been stronger sanctions. The one thing that I will say about Crimea is I do think we and the Ukrainians, and here I mean Europe, the United States, and the Ukrainians, used the time between the annexation of Crimea and now to build a very impressive Ukrainian defense force. The Ukrainian military fights like a modern military. They fight with deception and maneuver. And it's part of the reason the Russians are having such trouble. They fight like a 20th, 19th century force. And so I think Ukraine got stronger after the annexation of Crimea. I think Ukraine started to heal some of its internal conflicts, and clearly a strong sense of Ukrainian national identity, even with those in the East, emerged. And so while I would have hoped we would have done more, that time was not lost.
Tatiana Voroshko is managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service. She was speaking with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.